Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Memorial Day. First Memorial Day observed as Decoration Day on May 30th of 1868 to honor those who died in the Civil War. It was traditional to decorate the graves of veterans with flowers, wreaths, and crosses. And at the very first Decoration Day service, more than 20,000 Union and Confederate soldier graves were honored at Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia. The holiday officially became Memorial Day in 1967. This hour of the program, it's All Things Political, Monday at 9, and we're happy actually to return to Iowa. Remember the live broadcast we did, two of them actually, from Dubuque, Iowa. It was in the cold, cold, bitter January of Iowa, and we thought that it would be timely to go back to Iowa. And two of the guests who were with us on one of our panel discussions, Clinton and Obama, are still dominating the news. We're paying a little bit more attention to that race, and we're also paying attention to Senator Clinton's comments when she was asked about the presidential race to a paper in South Dakota. She said that she had made it clear that she thought the urgency to end the 2008 primary process was unprecedented. And she pointed out, as she had before, that her husband's primary campaign and Senator Robert Kennedy's, who had been assassinated in June, had continued into June. She has said that her comments were taken entirely out of context and interpreted them to mean something completely different and something completely unthinkable. This has created quite a stir. This morning, I went to the Washington Post to print an article about the appearances yesterday on Fox News by Terry McAuliffe, and the response, I couldn't stop the printer from printing. There were hundreds of pages, actually. I will recycle them, I guarantee you. But there were so many comments referring to her comments that I think it's an issue that's still fairly large. We'll also be talking about Senator John McCain, who seems to be running even with both Clinton and Obama, and why that is the case. There aren't many delegates left on the Democratic side, and we'll ask, is it Iowa that really was the turning point in this whole race and the beginning of Obama's victory? There were comments over the weekend on Meet the Press that Bill Clinton has said that Hillary has earned nothing short of her being Obama's running mate. And so there's a whole lot to talk about this hour. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And you can also send an email if you'd like. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We'd be particularly interested as we return to Dubuque this hour to talk with some of you who are at our broadcast in Dubuque. We have two guests with us, Professor David Carroll Cochran, Associate Professor of Politics at Loras College in Dubuque. Professor Cochran, welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, our pleasure. And also joining us is Professor Christopher Budzis, who is Associate Professor of Politics, also at Loras College in Dubuque. And nice to have you on the air again, Professor.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Let's start with these comments by Hillary Clinton. I mentioned this morning that I was trying to get off the printer something else. And when I looked at the blogs that were written in response to Terry McAuliffe on Fox News and to the Clinton comments about why she's staying in past June, there are literally hundreds of pages of comments. I've never seen anything like this before. Tell me what your response was to those comments. Obviously, there are a number of people who are saying, why did she say this?
Well, I think one of the things that it taps into is a concern that's been out there, and it's been voiced several times about since Obama is a new type of candidate, the first African-American candidate, and Michelle Obama, I believe herself, has voiced this publicly, concerns about Senator Obama's safety and things like that. So I think that, by and large, Clinton made a comment that was not, you know, reading through it, it was not intended to signal that kind of thing or to tap that. But I think one of the things you've seen with the size of the response is that inadvertently, I think she stumbled upon something that's been sort of inchoate and out there that people have been concerned about.
Right. I just can't imagine what was in her mind that would cause her to say something like that. It was a time of great trauma for this country. People don't like to be reminded of that. Why in the world, subconsciously, was she bringing that up? Nobody can quite figure it out.
Yeah, and I don't know that I would want to get in the business of psychoanalyzing a candidate, but I would say this, that they do so, as you know, they do so many interviews to so many people, and when you're thinking aloud, in this generation, at least in terms of media generation, everything that you think aloud is actually going to come out and is recorded for posterity. So I think in some cases, I tend to believe that it was not intended as a specific reference to, to Senator Obama.
Mm-hmm. Professor Budzitz, Professor Cochran, what do you think about her response to her comments?
I think that, I agree with Chris that I think it was just unintentional. She was searching for examples of nomination fights that had gone into the summer and settled upon this one. And then also mentioning the 92 one I thought was probably even more questionable just because the example isn't apt at all. Her husband had it easily locked up by this point in 92. I think that we're at the point in the campaign where, you know, what you say in these responses are being so sort of micro-analyzed because it's the end game. Most people know that Obama's going to be the nominee, I think, and that it's a question of sort of manufacturing scandals almost based on comments that could be interpreted lots of ways, and then what's the response, and is it calibrated this way or that way, and I think it's all sort of a tempest in a teapot, frankly.
Mm-hmm. And yet when you look at the blogs on this, they are tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of pages. Why such a response from, and they're obviously from people who are very involved in either the Clinton campaign or the Obama campaign.
Yeah, I think both sides have an awful lot of true believers,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes we can, the number of blog entries we can sort of over-magnify to represent the population. These are still relatively small groups of people who are investing a lot of time and energy in both campaigns, and the emotional, I think, intensity has been ratcheted up as we get towards the end. So I think, and it taps in, like Chris said, it taps into, fears, obviously, about Obama being the new candidate, first major African-American candidate who has a shot at the presidency, fears of assassination, and so on. So there's a high emotional temperature, I think, and that comes out in a lot of the chatter on the blogs and on the talk shows and
mm-hmm.
things like that.
And I'm sure we'll hear from people this morning on those comments. Gentlemen, was Iowa the turning point for Senator Obama?
I would say that it wasn't. It certainly was important and significant for his campaign. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But I think the turning point rather comes in that February to March window where he won, 11 straight contests, basically. That turn of the tide for 3 or 4 weeks, I think that really was where the delegate math was largely molded and shaped to his advantage. And I think that's an advantage he's managed to maintain. In spite of Senator Clinton still being able to win some later victories, the last month for her or so has been relatively decent.
Mm-hmm.
But that month in February to March, the beginning of February to the beginning of March, was especially good for Senator Obama. And I think really that if you're going to go back and look, is it a combination of that stretch of time for Obama plus the Clinton campaign's difficulties in their strategy as it was laid out and the execution of their campaign in that same period.
A lot of people have been trying to figure out why it is that Obama did so well among white working-class Americans in Iowa, in Wisconsin, and did terribly in places like Kentucky and West Virginia. What do you think?
That is one of those big, I think, sort of question marks going into the general election, too, because it's going to be a relevant question in the fall. I think that, first of all, he tended to do better in caucus states. So Iowa being a caucus state, he did better among all groups in caucus states. You're talking about a smaller, perhaps more intense electorate. He was better, frankly, at organizing in these states. And so as far as Iowa goes, I think a lot of it was the fact that it was a caucus state and the expertise that he displayed in organizing leading up to it. And then just, I think the demographics are somewhat similar, but also somewhat different from states like Wisconsin to Ohio to Pennsylvania. And just campaign dynamics differ. Like Chris mentioned, the rhythm of the campaign They went through good stretches and bad stretches. So, you know, and even if it's 10 points here or there among particular subgroups, you can't read too much into that given just the way the campaign unfolds over time, I think.
Mm-hmm. What about the exit polls showing, and I'm wondering, this may not be a fair question, and we may hear from people from Kentucky or West Virginia, but when you look at the number of people polled who said they would not vote for an African American, the number was, you know, like 11%. It makes me wonder if those parts of the country are still a little bit more racist than other parts of the country.
I think race definitely is, and we talked about this, I remember, back in January on your show.
Yeah.
And I remember, and I may be completely wrong about this down the road, I remember making the argument, someone at least, that Obama's race, being the first African-American, if he gets the nomination to run as a major party nominee, could actually help him more among white voters than hurt him, just because the dynamics of race and the way, the complex ways that certain subgroups of the white population respond to race. But, frankly, some of these numbers of voters who imply that they could not vote for him because of his race could hurt him in some key swing states. I think the question is, will he be able to make up any votes he loses simply because he's African-American by picking up independent swing voters, especially suburban women, who are more attracted to the idea of breaking this barrier and voting for the first African-American candidate. So I think his race still could cut either way, and it's going to be an interesting thing to look at the data as we go
right.
forward about how that works.
Do you agree with that, Professor Budzitz?
Yeah, I do, in fact. I think, as Dave mentioned, that within certain subgroups of the white population, they actually would see his something redemptive, I think is the word, the phrase that Dave used in January, that sometimes people will imbue his candidacy with a sort of redemptive character. And so that could actually help him. And in some of these states, too, one thing to consider, it doesn't discount this element, but it would just say as an explanation of electoral decision in November, some of these states where he's having the most trouble with white voters are states that he would have trouble in the general election winning anyway when it comes to the Electoral College math.
Mm-hmm.
So in states like Iowa and Wisconsin, his ability to attract white voters, and in Iowa, Dave's exactly right. It's, you know, if you look at Senator Obama, he did extraordinarily well in caucus states. But his ability to tap white voters in Iowa and Wisconsin, if he can maintain that, will help him quite a bit because those states could very well be in play, whereas some of these other states, he isn't. And Dave, I think, is right in focusing on states like Ohio and Pennsylvania. Those will be some of the key states to see if this dynamic continues to work out. But my guess is in that suburban areas, he might actually benefit in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Clinton senior strategist Howard Wolfson on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday was talking again about Michigan and Florida. He said the campaign believes that the DNC will reinstate Florida and Michigan 100%. That's what they should do, he said. That will obviously help us, but that is the right thing to do. There's obviously a bit of controversy about that. Do you have any inkling of what they're going to do? It's this Saturday, right?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure. My view has always been that there will be folks from Michigan and Florida at the convention just because it would be terrible press to not have them there, but that it would always be in a way that was least disruptive. That is, once we know who the nominee is, you either split them down the middle or you seat them as they were, as long as it doesn't affect the outcome. So I think what the party would love to do is seat the two delegations as long as they don't affect the outcome and thereby reward them for essentially breaking the rules. And I can understand why Clinton and her campaign obviously wants them there. I think comparing them to Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe was probably a stretch. But they obviously care passionately about doing everything they can to change the math, which is not running in their favor. But I can't see the party letting Michigan and Florida tip the nomination to Clinton. I just can't see them doing it.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests. We return to Iowa for this hour of all things political, and two guests who we were happy to have with us during our live broadcast in Dubuque, Professor David Carroll Cochran, Associate Professor of Politics at Loras College in Dubuque, Professor Christopher Budzis, who is Associate Professor of Politics also at Loras College in Dubuque. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. What do you think is fair when dealing with the Michigan and Florida voters? What about Senator Clinton's comments referencing the assassination of Robert Kennedy as one of the reasons that she stayed in the race past June, because you don't know what's going to happen? She also said her husband didn't wrap up his campaign until June in 1992. Why did she even say this? We also will be talking about Senator John McCain, who seems to be running pretty even with Senator Clinton and Senator Obama in the polls. Why is that? He's also had some disarray in his candidacy, his staff, big turnover, a number of lobbyists. He's been criticized for being the guy who's taken on the lobbyists, and then several lobbyists in the campaign have had to leave. So let's talk to you. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee, or you could send an email, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Memorial Day, we'll talk about whether income disparity and race are more influential in educational achievement than gender. All right, let's go to some phone calls for our guests. They are both Associate Professor of Politics at Loras College in Dubuque, Iowa. One line is open. Feel free to join us, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050, if you join us in Milwaukee. Matt from Appleton, hi.
Yes, hi. I did want to comment on Hillary's Robert Kennedy statement. I personally thought they were dubious and reckless, at least. You know, and when it went out Friday afternoon, it definitely sent out shockwaves. And the Obama camp responded, I believe, by saying that those kind of statements had no place in the campaign, which I thought was fairly restrained. And then to have Terry McAuliffe turn around and try to blame the Obama camp, saying that they were inflaming the situation, I thought was unforgivable.
Professor Cochran, you want to start?
Sure. I'll just say as a campaign tactic, the Obama campaign has been very skilled. The old rule in politics is if your opponent's in a train wreck, just get out of the way. And so I think they're at the point of the campaign where they are, any mistakes the Clinton campaigns make, they nudge them perhaps a little, but they essentially let the campaign sort of, you know, fall over itself, and they've handled it, I think, tactically, certainly very well. Enough outrage to keep it going, but also enough dignity not to turn it into a circus, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Obama's response, he essentially said, well, it's tired, you get tired, it's been a long campaign, sometimes you say things that you don't really mean, was a strong enough response, Professor Budzis?
Yeah, I do. I agree with Dave. You sort of get out of the way because you know the media is going to discuss this, and you know that the blogosphere and everything else we've discussed already is going to maintain the conversation in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might just think back in some cases to Obama's comment about Reagan. It's different in the sense of maybe the severity of the comment or what it taps into, but, you know, the blogosphere and everything else got upset about that. And one thing I would say about blogs and things that is that Dave mentioned, I think, the phrase "the end game." You know, that we're looking in some ways to finalize this contest. And I think for supporters on both sides, this is just one of those opportunities to take a comment and, you know, to score political points in a way. It's an opening in a contest where time is running out in many ways. And as Dave mentioned, that Obama certainly looks to be the nominee, but Senator Clinton is not leaving. And so this can be used as an opportunity to sort of push, and I think that's you know, perfectly in keeping in line with American politics.
Mm-hmm. When do you think this whole thing's going to be over, Professor Cochran?
Uh, I think you might have asked me that back in January, and I, you know, did the old, well, after Super Tuesday, probably
right.
we'll know most of it. You poor people in Wisconsin won't really get a chance.
Yeah,
but,
look what happened.
That shows what happened. I think I don't think it's going to go to the convention as much as, you know, the political junkie me would like to see an old-fashioned convention fight. I suspect we'll let the final primaries run their course, and by, you know, early June, I think we'll have Obama as the nominee, and then the we'll let the healing begin, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Professor Budzitz, you think so?
Yeah, I think that's right. Even though I'm a registered Republican and would love to see a floor fight for both political junkie reasons and partisan reasons, I certainly don't think that there's the Democratic Party, if it would allow such a thing to occur, would be in really bad shape.
Right.
I agree. And to be honest, I think Senator Clinton, if she can find a way to see herself through this, I think that if there was an opportunity that could be worked out, I think
mm-hmm.
that would be something that would be taken in advance of the convention.
What do you think, Matt?
I guess I'm still obsessing on this Robert Kennedy thing.
Yeah.
I guess I just want to say that I think Obama has showed remarkable restraint.
All right. Thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thanks.
Let's enter John McCain into this for a while. The polls are still showing that he is running very close to either of the candidates, the Democratic candidates, Clinton or Obama. Let's go with you because you're a registered Republican, Professor Budzitz. Well, does that indicate that it's just going to be a very, very close race? What do you make of his running neck and neck at this point?
Yeah, I would do the standard academic line about taking everything that you see right now with a grain of salt because the head-to-head matchups right now, what they might be instructive in telling you is maybe a sort of floor that someone's support might have or just some general impression of strength. But in terms of projecting forward in any concrete fashion, I think that's a little tricky. When I was on the program in January, I said, you know, one of the things about Obama is that he has the opportunity to energize and a base or energize a segment of voters in ways that could be quite profound. And so I think it's hard right now when he's still dealing with Senator Clinton in that race for the nomination to project forward with any sort of clarity. I think McCain, out of all the candidates on the Republican side, is probably the one who at this point would be in the best chance, with the best position for the fall. I certainly think some of the other candidates would have proven weaker and would likely prove weaker. But that being said, to be honest, I don't really, when I see a most recent Newsweek poll was 46-46, I think, in an Obama-McCain national matchup. Well, one thing to note is that we don't do a national race like that. We do it electoral college, state by state, and so that you have to put in there as a grain of salt. And the other thing you have to realize is that the dynamics and the contours of the general election matchup, the issue ads and the issues that come forward and everything else, we haven't seen yet. And so I think it's a little too early to say that, you know, this is going to be a deadlocked race. I do think the electoral math provides an opening for McCain, but it's certainly not a sort of wide-open door by any stretch of the imagination. I think the Democrats and Senator Obama, by extension, have an advantage.
Mm-hmm. Professor Cochran.
Yeah, I agree with the sort of caution about reading these polls too carefully now. It is a good, the Democrats can be encouraged by the general environment, which seems to be, aside from who the candidates are, the general electoral environment certainly would favor them. But I've cautioned my fellow Democrats, I'm a registered Democrat, I've cautioned them about overconfidence just because I'm 40 years old, and in my lifetime, no Democratic nominee has gotten more than 50% of the popular vote. Carter just barely got to 50, and Clinton in both his runs came below 50. Gore got less than 50. So since the mid-1960s, Democrats have had a really, really hard time getting a large percentage of the popular vote, whereas Republicans routinely pass the 50% threshold. So the larger systemic situation might favor Democrats in some ways, but there's still Republicans just have a better track record in presidential elections getting that mass of voters.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday's New York Times had, I believe, a front page story on the role of of lobbyists in Mr. McCain's inner circle. They said this, Terry Nelson, who was Mr. McCain's campaign manager until he left last fall. The core image of John McCain is as a reformer in Washington. The more dominant the story is about the lobbying teams around him, the more you put that in question. If the Obama campaign can truly change him from being seen as a reformer to just being another Washington politician, it could be very damaging over the course of the campaign. What do you think, Professor Buzis?
I think that's true, although I think you have to, that's one of these issues you have to be very careful on, because if you spend a great deal of your time as Senator Obama picking through the campaign staff of Senator McCain, one thing that's come back is clearly that Senator McCain's going to do the same thing to Senator Obama's, and you'll find lobbyists on Senator Obama's campaign. So it's one of those things where I don't think it will be put forward as a first issue. What I think it might be become for Senator Obama is part of this narrative about change in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, he's vulnerable on this. You can't swing a cat without hitting a lobbyist or a former lobbyist. So in a way, that's a tricky issue, but you probably want to sort of fold it into this general change thing. And if you do look at some of the people's perceptions of strengths and attributes, change very much redounds to his benefit, Senator Obama's benefit. Whereas McCain sort of loses on this change business. But when it comes to experience, McCain tends to score better amongst people looking for experience. Mm.
Let's go to Ken from Milwaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to digress, if I may, and ask a question with two standpoints. One has to do with who's first, specifically referring to New Hampshire and Iowa, and why, and the only word that can come to my mind, is it fair that they're always first? And because they were meant to be first for the parties, in the Democratic Party, they put the rules in that basically threw out what Florida and Michigan were doing. And the Rules Committee is made up of mostly Hillary's people, and yet she's the one who doesn't want to follow those rules and applying for the seating of the delegates for Florida and Michigan. So can all this be tied together and understand why, who's first, and does it have to stay that way? And now that it was decided that way, why is the person whose group makes up the majority of the Rules Committee is trying to deviate from those rules just because it would benefit? So just thought I'd throw that out and ask.
Okay, thanks for the call. Professor Cochran.
Yeah, that's a great question. I used to think that it was fairly absurd that Iowa and New Hampshire went first until I moved to Iowa. And now I'm a fervent believer in keeping it that way. It's an accident of history. These were the states that scheduled it first. No one realized how significant it would be, not just politically but economically, to have all this money pour into the state every 4 years. And so now there's almost this vested interest in both states keeping it, and they use leverage over presidential candidates to, get them to promise to keep it that way. It could easily change if the parties wanted it to change, but I think the idea of two smaller states going first, get that retail politics, baptism of fire kind of thing, I think the parties like that. It minimizes the chance you're going to have someone come through who maybe isn't as strong a candidate, but it doesn't necessarily have to be Iowa and New Hampshire. There's plenty of ideas to rotate primaries, regional primaries, things like that. And then, of course, as far as the rules thing go, Senator Clinton is trying to do what she can to maximize her advantage. She didn't seem to have an objection to punishing Florida and Michigan before the math worked out where she would now need Florida and Michigan. So I think it's what you usually see in politics, is you adjust and try and make the strongest argument you can to maximize your advantage. And I think it's just unfortunate that she's had to sort of flip her position on this particular thing. And as a citizen of Iowa, I definitely want to see any state that tries to sneak ahead punished as severely as possible.
Let's go to Mohammed from Madison. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my
call.
I'll be very honest. As an African-American, I had never heard of Reverend Wright before he was sort of outed as Senator Obama's spiritual mentor or whatever. There was never any incident where he was brought out as having endorsed Senator Obama. And similarly, I had never heard of Reverend Hagee and Reverend Parsons before they endorsed Senator McCain. Over the weekend, and I don't have cable television, but I was in Milwaukee, and I had a chance to see Reverend Hagee and Reverend Parsons almost accidentally their program, and they are scary to me as an African American, or I'll say as a non-Christian and as a Muslim. Both of them are very scary when you look into their theology. My question is, why haven't they had the drag on Senator McCain, even though he's disendorsed them somewhat, that Senator Obama had with respect to his relationship or past relationship with Reverend Wright?
Professor Budzitz.
I think there's a couple things that help explain that. One is that, that, as you've just mentioned, Senator McCain disendorsed, if that's a word, or refused the endorsement of these individuals. Now, that wasn't the case immediately, in one of the cases anyway. He had shown up at the same event and things. But he has distanced himself from those in strong terms, saying that he doesn't accept, he rejects their endorsement. He sort of just flatly said it. Whereas under Obama's relationship, it wasn't a sort of clear statement rejecting. In fact, he refused to reject for reasons that are significant. And the other thing that I think makes it different, or one other thing that makes it different, is that these weren't personal pastors or personal mm-hmm. Sort of mentors for Senator McCain. I will say this, though, that as the caller sort of points to, is that with Reverend Wright, it does tap into a much deeper or into a sort of cultural and racial vein that I think is sometimes difficult to do publicly and talk about publicly. But I think that those two reasons, the rejection of the endorsement, in addition to the fact that these are not close personal pastors of Senator McCain, because we need to remember he's always had a pretty uncomfortable relationship with the religious right, Senator McCain has.
What are they going to do in terms of voting for him? Can he count on them, or are they not going to go to the polls, or what?
This is one of those things that I think only time will tell, and it will. Some of the things that you won't know until the general election unfolds, because if the tenor and tone of the election start, and disinformation campaigns are out there about Senator Obama and being a Muslim and things like that, those kind of things, unfortunately, could tap into a sort of vote for McCain as a rejection of Obama rather than a vote for McCain because they like McCain.
Mm.
You might, depending on the rhetoric and tone of not only the official campaigns, but most importantly, the non-official entities, the 527s and other groups we talk about, depending on the tenor, you could see them come out and lodge a sort of anti-Obama vote, and perhaps for misinformed reasons and everything else, but perhaps for legitimate reasons.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Marty from Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning, everybody.
Hello.
At the risk of sounding like the most insensitive person in Wisconsin, I think this brouhaha over the statement by Senator Clinton is way, way out of context. Goodness knows, everybody who's ever said anything ever has said things that they, just sort of off the cuff have said. And I got her point that, and let me say, I'm not necessarily a Clinton supporter. I got her point. A lot of people did not pull out in June. Why should she? But to my question has to do more. Let's get on to the vice presidential conversation here. I see that Mr. McCain had a little picnic this weekend. And one name that I didn't see on the guest list, at least yesterday, he had Mitt Romney and then I believe two governors visiting. But I didn't see Tim Pawlenty included on that A list. I'm wondering if your guests have any insight into that. And then Bill Clinton is saying Hillary deserves to be vice president. Is that what they're shooting for now?
Whoever wants to start.
I'll jump in. I know, and okay. I can give credit to Chris because he's been mentioning Pawlenty for months now as sort of a perfect running mate for McCain. I think that yesterday was more of a public relations kind of thing I think just because someone didn't make the barbecue yesterday doesn't mean they're not on the short list. It was more of a let's get in the news, let's try and stay public, and also notice that he's whoever he publicly invites, he's sort of reaching out to different constituencies within the party symbolically and so on. And then I think on the Clinton side, first of all, I tend to be one of those people who believes no one deserves the vice presidency any more than anyone deserves the presidency.
Hmm.
And vice presidents are picked, A, if they don't do any harm, and B, if they can do a little bit of help. They don't make a whole lot of difference either way. And I think probably the Obama camp has to think it's too risky. If they can get away with not picking Senator Clinton, I have to think they won't, just because of, I mean, Chris just mentioned McCain's potential turnout problem. And if you put a Clinton on the ticket, it could only help to energize the right, the old anti-Clinton coalition, that kind of thing. So I think you probably would avoid putting Senator Clinton on the ticket just for the usual reasons that you choose vice presidents. But perhaps in the interest of party unity, or you think you don't have the option to turn her down, then maybe you do some kind of fusion ticket.
Hmm. You agree with that, Professor Buzzard?
Yeah, I do. And the three people the caller mentioned, they didn't see Governor Pawlenty, but there was Governor Crist from Florida and Governor Jindal from Louisiana. And I think for Jindal, it doesn't make much sense in regards to him. He just won the governorship recently. So, you know, months in office, basically, even though he served in different capacities before then. But as Dave mentioned, I think he's reaching out to different constituencies. I think one reason why you didn't see Pawlenty at that barbecue is because Senator McCain is very familiar with Governor Pawlenty. Governor Pawlenty has long been a supporter of McCain's presidential bid and has appeared in advertisements with McCain or form of the McCain campaign for months and months, if not over a year now. So he's more familiar with him. You know, and you do see quite a number of the other governors mentioned, Mark Sanford in South Carolina, but you also see other names. Pawlenty's a big one, Chris Cox, who's now the SEC chair, former congressman. And then I would just throw one name out there that you don't hear a whole lot, but that's John Kasich, who's from Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be, you know, as we've hit again, states, a state that's going to be important. It's not as though VPs can always deliver a home state, but if you can put someone on the ticket who has a certain appeal, that helps. You know, Senator Kerry, when he picked Edwards, found out that it choosing someone doesn't guarantee anything.
What about Huckabee? You haven't mentioned him.
No, I haven't, and I think he suffers from a similar problem that that Dave mentioned earlier. Is that I think for Huckabee, while he does certainly have an appeal within certain segments of the Republican Party, I think, unfortunately for him, he was tied very closely with one segment of the party. Even though on positions, he's actually quite attractive in many cases to more general voters, but he was very much freighted with the sort of Christian right, which I think might be nice for McCain if he's appealing to his base, but he's done with the primary. He just needs to do something to make sure that those people don't leave, and may make sure that they come out. But he doesn't necessarily have to give them exactly what they would want, because they're just one segment of a broader coalition that he's going to need to build. So I think that Huckabee, and Romney's also mentioned quite a bit too.
Yes.
But I think those two, Huckabee and Romney, it's certainly with precedent to choose a former rival. There's been plenty of cases of that. The one tricky side in those two cases is that they come very freighted with baggage that might not be particularly helpful in a general election campaign.
Thanks so much, Marty, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, Memorial Day. And our guests are from Dubuque, Iowa, where we did our live broadcast in the cold days of January. And it was a momentous time for us, and perhaps for the campaign as well. Professor David Carroll Cochran, Associate Professor of Politics at Loras College, who's a registered Democrat. Professor Christopher Budzis, a registered Republican, Associate Professor of Politics at Loras College as well. And the school is in Dubuque. We have had pretty full phone lines. Let me just give you the number and try and get through if you can. 800-486 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now, and let's go to Elaine. Thanks for waiting, Elaine, from Colfax. Hi.
Hi. Hillary Clinton is ending her campaign in disgrace. I think it's desperate and mean. Her comment about Robert Kennedy's assassination is reprehensible. I mean, both to the Kennedy family, who is dealing with a very serious health issue with the senior Edward Kennedy. Also, there's no way to take that comment other than someone could murder Barack Obama. It's calculated to tap into fear, and that seems to be her only weapon in a desperate campaign. She could have left on a high note with grace, trying to show that she's a strong female candidate, like she's trying to portray herself. But if it's not a calculated attempt to make people afraid, then it's stupid. It just reveals a stupendous callousness. And it's worse than her lie about being shot at when she was the first lady, which a video of the time that she said this happened revealed absolutely nothing like that occurred. I think this totally and utterly disqualifies her as a candidate for vice president. And I think Obama has really been classy and distinguished through all this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Professor Cochran.
I certainly agree. I'm an Obama supporter myself, and I certainly agree that he showed a lot of poise and class in the whole campaign, including sort of here at the end. I'm not sure I agree so much with the criticisms of Senator Clinton not dropping out. I mean, it's hard. Normally, when the person who's in second drops out of the caucuses or primaries, they're way behind. But if you look at the numbers, they have basically split the Democratic electorate down the middle. If they're not tied mathematically, they're basically tied. I mean, there's been 4,000 delegates chosen, and they're only, what, 200-300 apart. So dropping out of a race where you're basically winning half the states, some by big margins, where you're getting just about as many delegates as your opponent, it's one of those things where it's hard to criticize someone for not dropping out when they're clearly still in the game and doing well. And so I think, like Chris mentioned before, she's probably looking for a way to bow out gracefully without bowing out of a game that you still, you know, are in and still doing well in. And so it's been a very unique season in that we haven't had for a long time, despite Senator Clinton's allusions to past years, we just haven't had two candidates this close, each taking about half the Democratic primary vote in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Mark from Medford. Hi, Mark.
Oh, good morning, everyone. Happy Memorial Day. I'm curious, what are the origins of this remarkable Obama campaign? Did any group of people or organization approach him and say, we think you'd make a great presidential candidate, or was it all self-induced?
Well, my understanding of it is that it was not, as most things, it's not completely self-induced. Senator Obama has done the right thing, talked to the correct people, and have been identified by the right people and the correct people in Chicago area politics for quite a while now. And I think the 2004, most people point to his 2004 speech at the Democratic National Convention as placing himself firmly on the national scene. He benefited from a Senate race, which was, you know, just shy of uncontested, so that really helped him because of a strange set of circumstances. And so, you know, you rise to prominence as an African American senator from, you know, the state of Lincoln, and you also with a tremendous personal narrative experience in the state house, and then you also have his sort of national exposure through his well-received speech in the 2004 Democratic National Convention. And so I think that there were people who were, if not seeing him for the 2000 race, seeing him several years back as certainly someone who has a place in national Democratic politics.
Hmm. I'll just echo that. I think that Obama certainly has a rare and tremendous political talent. and charisma, and that certainly has helped him in this very quick rise. What I was very surprised with, pleasantly surprised with, is he also has put together a very highly competent campaign.
Yes.
He's been very unflappable, this campaign, over the course of the last 6 months or so, and there's still plenty of time for internal scandals to erupt and so on before November, but you haven't seen a whole lot of internal campaign problems, shakeups, a few gaffes here and there, but no more than normal, and I think probably better than normal for a campaign. So he combines this great charisma with also sort of the ability to put together a really top-notch organization that hasn't made many mistakes.
Right, and he hasn't, just to add to that, he's been very good at not hurting himself, and he's made the smart, and his David Axelrod and others have made decisions that have really helped this by, for instance, he's not always talking to press and media, whereas some other candidates are. And I think that you increase your likelihood for gaffes and those kind of things. But he also is, as Dave mentioned, shown quite a bit of restraint. And I think the campaign itself has been well run, and their strategy has turned out to be superior. They had mapped out post Super Tuesday contests, and I think that's important.
Who would have thought this some time ago, and not all that long ago? It is a remarkable story, isn't it, gentlemen?
Well, it is, although I think I vaguely remember in January, everyone was saying that the election, well, not everyone, there were some people saying that the election is over, and then a week later in New Hampshire when Senator Clinton wins, oh, the election's not over, and then a week later it's over again. So I think for the first month, I think there was a sense of disbelief in that it's not going to go this long. But then I think after that first couple of contests, people then realized, well, wait a second, this really is for the long haul. So when we look back the last couple of months, it certainly seems as though this has come out of the blue. And I think that in many ways, the hand-wringing by Democrats, some Democrats, about the harm to the party, I think still is a bit overblown. And I think that they still stand in pretty good shape in the fall. And I would say quickly that one thing we haven't talked about, you don't hear much about, is that the Democrats are likely to do very well in Congress as well. And it's just
right. In
the congressional election, it's just a numbers game. In the Senate, for instance, the Republicans have to defend almost two times as many seats as the Democrats, and the Republicans in the House have 34 open seats, or six open seats, sorry, and they're in the Senate and 34 seats in the House. So mass numbers of Republican defections too, or retirements. So I think that the party's in decent shape, even though this seems gut-wrenching at times and everything else. I think the party's still in decent shape, but I also think McCain, out of all the GOP candidates, is the one that electorally anyway, if you look at the electoral math, has a chance.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. The point that I'd like to make builds around the theme that if the press really isn't liberal, the press is actually leans conservative, and I think the proof of it is in the way that McCain's has been treated. For example, in the March 17th, 2008 New Yorker, John McCain is quoted as making a joke saying, "Why is Chelsea Clinton so ugly? Because Janet Reno is her father." That's a direct quote from the article. Imagine if Obama had to, deal with something like that. And Pastor Hagee called the Catholic Church a great whore and also a false cult system. He said that God sent Hitler to force the Jews back to the land of Israel. I mean, this kind of craziness is basically unchallenged. And also there's the impact of the right wing on the Supreme Court. The right wing religious Neil Steinberg in the Chicago Sun-Times says the election is about what will happen after the government seizes your cousin at O'Hare and packs him off to a secret CIA torture center in Turkey. And his appeal finally reaches the Supreme Court in 2012. Who do you want hearing his plea for justice? So I think the media has given McCain a pass. And if Obama had made these kind of mistakes and these kinds of associations, there would have been tons more publicity about it.
Professor Cochran?
I do think that charges of liberal bias in the media have been overblown for some time. I'm not sure it goes the other way. I think it's more the press tends to like good stories, and they also tend to warm up to candidates and to particular figures. And McCain has, you're right, I think your caller's correct, he's enjoyed a very good relationship with the press over the years, but I think Obama has as well. It's going to be interesting in the fall because you have two characters, two candidates who the press has normally been very warm towards, and to see how they sort of adjust to that is going to be interesting. And we have to keep in mind, just on the second part of your caller's comments, is that, you know, 6 months ago, the reason McCain was having so much trouble in the Republican caucuses and primaries was he wasn't trusted on a lot of these issues by the right, on detainees, on torture, on abortion, on a lot of these things. Many people on the right don't think he's necessarily a true believer, and in fact has spoken out against conservative positions, again, on torture and things like that. So it's also interesting to see how these positions shift as you get nominees. And so people who, these positions tend to shift once you get the nominee in position and they have to tack either left or right. And the press is going to have to figure out sort of how to handle a fight. They want a good, mean, ugly fight between two people they've always said are very nice, decent, genuine human beings.
Right. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It was great to speak with you again. We have fond memories of our time in Dubuque. Thanks.
Thank you.
Back anytime.
Okay, all right, we will. Thanks. Our guests from Loras College in Dubuque, they were on our broadcast the day of the caucuses there, Professor David Carroll Cochran, Associate Professor of Politics at Loras, and also Professor Christopher Budzis, Associate Professor of Politics at Loras College. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee, and thanks for your calls, everybody. We have news coming up, and we'll return for this Memorial Day. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.